Welcome, everybody, to Jawanza for Life, also known as Health, Wealth, and Divine. Oh, my God, y'all ready, I see. I see you're ready. The phone lines are already lit. I mean, the board is full. The word went out, and you all responded. And want to say head tap to everybody that's on the line. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you so much for taking time out of your busy day to spend it with my person and my special guest of the hour. I've got a treat for you all tonight. Once I found out that I was doing this interview, I was very, very excited about it and couldn't wait to get to it. I was counting down the days, actually, as the days approached to this point, this moment in time. I've got an offering that I want to share with you. There's going to be a book party in Washington, D.C. on April the 7th, and we're going to tell you all about it. But this book party is not just any book party. Okay, this is a coming out party, if you will, of sorts. The author of the book is Brother Enensah Amen, and he's written a monumental, groundbreaking, if I might say, book. It's called Black Pharaoh. Okay, Black Pharaoh, and this is just volume one. Black Pharaoh, African DNA and Anthropology of the Ancient Egyptians. You know, for the longest time, information has been put out there that has kind of really hidden the true identity of the pharaohs of Egypt, the so-called pharaohs of Egypt. But with this book, and I've been reading it, it is so detailed and it is so, I mean, in-depth that you've got to get the book, first of all, in order for you to appreciate the interview that you're going to hear today. You really have to buy the book so that you can really see and have at your own disposal information that actually proves the identity of the ancient Egyptian, or shall I say, the ancient Kemetian pharaohs. So without further ado, I want to get to my special guest today. I'm going to let him introduce himself, okay? Some brothers, you just got to let them introduce themselves, all right? So, again, author of the awesome, groundbreaking book, Black Pharaoh, Brother Enensah Amen. Welcome to Jawanza for Life. It's great to have you.
It's great to be on with you, brother. I appreciate everything that you're doing here, you know, getting this very important information out to the people. We need it. You know, it's ours. Nobody needs it more than us. And you know, when you educate black people, when you help their position, you help the world. Actually, you know, we've definitely been helping the world grow and develop, you know, for quite some time. This book, I've been underground studying this information intensely, you know, for a decade. It's good. I feel like I'm emerging, you know, from a mine, a gold mine. I've been underground finding all types of jewels, and you know, I'm dusty, you know, I'm rusty. I'm just getting back surface side and being able to, you know, get out and be more social. And it feels good because I discovered a lot of jewels down there that I'm eager to share with the world. You know, as you said, the text deals with the proof positive that, genetically speaking, the ancient Egyptians were black, but it goes much beyond that, because what I used to deal with their identity was anthropology. And so anthropology is not just the genetics, but it has four levels. So when you deal with anthropology, you have to deal with its three companion investigations. So you have to deal with the archaeology, you have to deal with the linguistics, and then you have to deal with the social culture. And the social culture that's the frontier for modern academics. You know, you would look at Harvard and Yale and Princeton and Brown and Oxford and Cambridge and, you know, all that they've done academically, all of the books and libraries and museums. And you would think that we pretty much have a good grasp of what, you know, the Egyptian information has to offer, even if you go and, you know, tear through all of those pages. But the reality is that we haven't even begun to scratch the surface. And when you do read the books that they provide, you find them admitting this. Zahi Hawass is, you know, someone I call him the president of Egyptology, mm-hmm. because of his position, his power and ability to okay or you know, ban people from studying Egypt. And he says in a book, Dawn, Egyptology at the Dawn of the 21st Century, that the future of Egyptology is to study the social culture. So, you know,
as opposed to
all that they've done, they have a grasp about of the social culture, and they know something about it, right? So he's saying that, you know, we've torn through the linguistics, we have all the translations, but we just don't understand the culture. We haven't okay. even begun to touch on trying to make sense of the culture. You know, so he
okay.
pegs that as a future study for Egyptologists. Just a few years ago, a scientist at University College London, Kevin McDonald, Dr. Kevin McDonald, announced the beginning, day one, of real African archaeology. How recent was that? We're in 2019. So in 2015, he announced the beginning of real African archaeology. And so the University College London is studying in the Sahel region. So that's where Tony Browder is doing his research. I know you're familiar with the text, Nile Valley Contributions to Civilization.
Yes.
Anthony Browder. So after that text, he was doing like Nile Valley tours. But he's also doing a lot of research in the Sahel because it's said that a lot of information is there, buried with the people, hidden.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of information that's hidden in places that are known about, that are known to the Tuareg people and the Siwas and different desert-dwelling people, the Dogons of Mali. And then there's information to find that's not known. You know, the Sahara Desert has not been really explored in depth beyond the parts of it that are easy to get to. So there's a newness to the information that's unexpected. And, you know, so it was very exciting, you know, finding some of that information. It was very, you know, I felt like I was in, you know, one of those pictures. What's the film? The Indiana Jones. You know, I felt like I was in one of those, scenarios. You know, while I was studying and just speaking to people about what the study was, you know, a lot of people were like, "Well, don't we have the books on that?" Like, you get the feeling, you hear the title Black Pharaoh, and it sounds familiar. It's like, well, it seems like we've heard that already. Seems like, you know, isn't that a book Diop wrote, or, you know, did Dr. Ben write that book, the Nat Geo, you know, like, isn't that out there already? Like, and it's not. Like, I had to check myself. I said, well, let me go and double check and make sure, you know, this hasn't been done already, and it really hasn't, you know, surprisingly. So, so beyond the DNA proof, there's some brand new material in this text, and you know, that really rewards beyond just proof, because it now gives us something to do. There's something new for us to study now. You know, so I'm looking forward to the universities getting a hold of the information and embracing new pathways for, you know, new fields of study and so forth.
So how does the book Beyond proving definitively based on archaeological evidence and DNA and so forth, beyond proving definitively that the original pharaohs or the builders of ancient Kemet were black, beyond that, how would that help, say, someone today? Okay, how would that,
right,
somebody looking back, they shrugging their shoulders and say, oh, okay, well, the black, they were black, the pharaohs were black. Okay, now what?
Right.
You know, how do
now,
I,
right,
you know what I'm saying? What's the next, how does that help the youth or
what
the young people today in terms of the future? Okay.
Like, you know, that's the thing right there. It's what do we do with this information? And I think that's the most exciting part, is that the book introduces a new approach to studying. And I'm gonna talk about that on a collegiate level and then on an elementary level. So
okay,
on the collegiate level, this text is offering a reboot for the field of anthropology. So the field of anthropology is the study of man. And because mainstream academics at the college level is helmed by Western thinkers, the study of man is really the Western approach to studying man. And yet, universally, if you're Indian, if you're Asian, if you're black, if you're white, and you're attending prestigious universities, you're studying man from the perspective of what Western culture understands is the proper way to go about doing that. And the ancients offered an alternative to how to go about doing that. And so this text lays a very solid foundation for the academics, the professorate, to come in and say, oh, we really have a viable, parallel curriculum to develop, whereas we can look at how do we study man in a different way. The ancients also gave their definition of man, their definition of self, their definition of life, and then they also gave us a framework by which to measure the value of life. So now we have an alternative to evolutionary science and the social sciences in terms of psychology, which is the study of man and the mind. Sociology, man and his interactions with people. Economics, man and society. You know, so this text lays down the foundation for what the ancients would have done under the banner of those fields of study. So on a college level, I expect that maybe not right away, but definitely within a few years, I expect there to be movement towards new fields of study, new sub-disciplines and so forth. Now, on an elementary level, I have a customer, a European woman, who's very excited about the book, and she approached me the other day, and she said, I really the book really got me very excited, and I was just overtaken by how ignorant I was about ancient Egypt. I thought their greatness was connected to the fact that they were just the worst dictators in all of history. And so, I put the book down, and I took my son to Brooklyn Museum and showed him the ancient Egyptian exhibit. He's 6 years old, and, I tried to give him a multicultural education. We have, children's books with, like, Hindu gods at home. We have children's books with the Greek mythology. Are there any, like, children's books that you can refer to me that just gives, like, a basic, like, 101 on ancient Egyptian culture, like the religion and the spirituality and all of that? And I was like, wow. I was like, well, check back with me in a couple of years. It'll probably be the one that I create,
Right.
So on an elementary level and on an everyday level for, people in their family life, The text also lays out a very simple introduction. It's embedded. It's not something you can open up and read to your six-year-old son, as this woman was looking for. But it lays out a very simple introductory key, a 101, so to speak, to what is the foundation of ancient Egyptian social culture. And in the text, it's referred to as the Pout Neteru, or the Tree of Life. And, you know, so it gives the Neteru, which have been in popular culture, they've been called deities. You know, it gives an alternative understanding to what the popular going notion is, because the going notion is that the gods that they dealt with was just this long, endless list. And there were gods that changed, you know, over time, and, you know, this, that, the other.
Mm-hmm.
So without there being like an overarching framework, there's never been able, no proper comprehension of ancient Egyptian religion or spirituality has ever been grasped in modern time. So what the Pout Neteru does, you know, as Shechem Shechem Rao Nefer Amen has taught it, what it does is it says, well, here are the 11 building blocks of life and spirituality. And from this 11, you can understand, and it's a closed system, so the interrelations of these 11 principles are sound and are complete, and they constitute a whole. And so now people are able to look at the pantheon as a complete, you know, life system, and then everything else that they see, all of the other Neteru that they come across are now derivatives of one of these 11 principles. You know, so the book is laying the seeds in the soil to, you know, giving people a more practical, you know, grasp of the ancient spiritual science. You know, I spoke at a college in New Jersey a couple of weeks ago, and it was a Catholic university, and you know, so all of them are, you know, they're Catholic Christians, they're, you know, folk of the Bible, and I was able to give them a comparison between, you know, the image of the Virgin Mary nursing baby Jesus with the image of or set nursing baby Heru. And, you know, I was able to explain that whereas the Bible tells you the story that Virgin Mary, nursed, you know, the baby Jesus, and, you know, this is something that people look at, they see the image, and they believe that it's a story that occurred, and it has like a snapshot kind of, it just gives you an image, you know, to worship, but without any definition and without any instruction, without anything you can actually go home and do. And so with the comedic understanding of that same image, the Virgin Mary, is, you know, it corresponds to what we call Osset, right? What the Greeks call Isis. And Osset being the mother of Heru, Osset is your devotion, and it is your it's the maternal energy, the ability for us to mother something. Jesus or Heru is you know, represents a righteous life, and so that image together represents you mothering your righteousness into adulthood. You're nourishing your righteousness, right? Your will to be righteous. And, you know, I told the students, I said, you know, the way a mother behaves with a newborn baby is that she never lets it drop. She, you know, at the middle of the night, if that baby is crying, you know, that mother is up in the middle of her sleep, tending to it, taking care of it right away, any, you know, at its beck and call. And so that paints a picture of how you should act in regards to cultivating your spirituality, you know, which is the baby Jesus, because your divinity, your spirituality right now is infinitesimal. It's a baby, you know, metaphorically speaking. And, you know, and so references like that go on and on, you know, in so much as, you know, the comedic information takes the spiritual information that we're more familiar with and, you know, gives us something, you know, to do right away, you know, because Oset is the mothering, but then it's also memory. It's also, you know, corresponds to meditation, you know. So mm-hmm. when you look at the comedic explanation of that same image, then it's like you're being instructed to go home and meditate as a direct way to nourish your baby notion of I need to do the right thing in the world. You know what I mean? You know, mm-hmm. so it gives you that direct instruction. You know, so. That's
everybody,
that's
I know you're enjoying this conversation mm-hmm. so far. The phone lines, the board is just packed. I mean, so everybody, if mm-hmm. at some point during this discussion you'd like to speak with my guest, all you have to do is just press 1 if you have a question or you just, you know, have a comment. I mean, you may have 1,000 questions, right? I mean, because we've all grown up. We've seen the Ten Commandments and other movies like that where ancient Egyptians were depicted as being other than black. I mean, they used white actors, or if not a white actor, you know, somebody with a, might have been somebody from the Middle East, somebody with a hue or something that they felt could, you know, they could get away with it. And that helped to program us and to create the image that we grew up having that the ancient Egyptians were other than black. So then when somebody does come and tell you that, oh, you know, the ancient Egyptians were black, you say, prove it, you know, in your mind, you know, they better prove it in order for you to believe it, because you're not going to just let go of your conditioning that easy, right? So they got to prove it. Well, this book proves it, okay? If you wanted proof, then you don't have to look any further than Black Pharaoh, okay? So during the course of this show, we're going to tell you all about the book party, how you can get the book, but Brother Nins, I'd like to ask you if you can break down, if you would, the dynasties. I mean, you know, many of us that have a limited knowledge or a passing knowledge of Egypt have, you know, heard of different dynasties, you know, the first dynasty. So-and-so was pharaoh of the fifth dynasty. What is a dynasty? And did the dynasties last? But was there a specific time frame that constituted a dynasty, you know, like 1,000 years is one dynasty, or was there a number equated with a dynasty? What is a dynasty, and how long is a dynasty, or was a dynasty?
Gotcha. So a dynasty, ancient Egyptian society was matriarchal in terms of the passing of the royal power. So mm-hmm. a dynasty in the structure, in the government structure of Kemet, you had a queen mother whose son was the king, and then whose daughter would be the next to be queen mother. And mm-hmm. so the kingship actually passed, you know, through the maternal line as opposed to through the paternal line. So long as a queen mother has a daughter, that daughter grows up and occupies the position of queen mother. Then she has a daughter. That daughter grows up, and there's a criteria now. So it's not just as you are the heir or the progeny of the queen mother, you will become the next queen mother. You actually had to graduate through the priesthood. So there was a likelihood that you would not grow to be queen mother. But so long as that happens, the dynasty lasts. The dynasties were an average of about 80 to 150 years. We didn't have any dynasties that lasted 1,000 years. ancient Kemet, the dynastic period, was itself a little over 2,000 years, and there were over 30 dynasties. So, okay. When you break that down, you get an average of, you know. So, and there were some 3 to 8 kings per dynasty. And okay. Now, What this book does is this book focuses on the early dynasties, so the dynasties 1 through 6 primarily. And then it jumps to the Middle Kingdom to deal with the dynasty of Amesh Nefertari and Hatshepsut. And it does that. That's very important for us to focus on the earlier dynasties and not all of them, because we've been guilty of a grave error, which is like a mass reductionism. It's a crime we've been committing unto ourselves, is trying to reduce ancient Egypt to this one snapshot historically and culturally. So we think that all ancient Egyptians were the same culturally. They weren't. There were several different stories from one dynasty to the next. And then, of course, you know, the crime that we commit in terms of, you know, attributing all of ancient Egyptian history to what the Bible calls Pharaoh, which is a character that is positioned in the later, much later dynasties, you know, down close to like the 27th, 28th dynasty. And what this text is focusing on are the people that are more responsible for what the culture actually is. And so the culture was cooked in the early dynasties. The culture was lived out in the later dynasties. But in the Old Kingdom, dynasties, you know, 1 through 6, that's where the Great Pyramids were built. These are the people who were ancient enough to remember who actually designed the hieroglyphic writing system. This is where the Pau Ntarrou was conceived. This is where a lot of the priesthoods that made Kemet great from a social, economic standpoint, you know, were developed. So this is where all where the discipline was honed, were in the early dynasties. You know, so one of the problems with modern Egyptology is that it's archaeological before it's anything else. So it's kind of like a majority rules kind of, you know, thing in terms of where people place their focus. So because there's a lot more archaeological, a lot more artifacts to find from the late dynasties, most of Egyptology revolves around later dynasty figures. So there's a lot of talk about King Tut. There's a lot of talk about Nefertiti, Moses, so-called Pharaoh, Akhenaten, Silver Pharaoh, all of these late dynasty people. And these people did not have anything to do with creating hieroglyphs. They had nothing to do with building pyramids. King Tut, Nefertiti, the Ptolemies, Cleopatra, figures like that were late dynasty people. They were Johnny-come-lately. They were newcomers. They saw the pyramids. They never saw a pyramid being built, you know, which is very important. So when we look at the Old Kingdom, the early dynasty people, these are the people where, when we talk about the greatness of Kemet, that's the forum where all of that culture was cooked in the early dynasties.
So let's deal with the Hebrews for a second, you know, just simply from the standpoint, historical fact. You know, we've seen the Ten Commandments and other movies where, you know, and even accounts, even in the Bible, where it talked about how the Hebrews were held in bondage by the Egyptians for 400 years. And in the movies, it shows the Hebrews actually, I guess, building some structures. I don't know if they were building pyramids, but they were in the pit working. I think they were building pyramids in the movie. Historically, where does that fit in, or is that just something that was created for the movies but not historically factual?
Right. Okay. So, yeah, that's a very important topic, because that's a topic that's very relevant to our people today. People are really grappling with that story very much, very fervently today. So there's a number of things to say about that. For one, you know, the Hebrews, the book that they deal with, the truth that they deal with, comes from the Bible. It comes out of the Bible. The Bible, in about six places in the entire text, references a pharaoh. Now, where we need to begin is that there were over 170 pharaohs. So which pharaoh are we talking about in the Bible when we say pharaoh? The Hebrews themselves, the Hebrews today, whether we're dealing with Hebrew Israelites or whether we're dealing with Israeli Jews, they have absolutely no idea which pharaoh the Bible is talking about. If you go to Torah.com now, you will be able to see the research from top Israeli Jewish scholars on this question, because this question made it to, you know, the grad schools, and they had to deal with it. And so the scholars have gone to great lengths to, you know, tearing through the Bible, tearing through biblical archaeological sites in Jordan, in Israel, in the surrounding area, looking for any clues as to which pharaoh are they talking about. And so the top Jewish scholars on Torah.com, they post their findings, and they let you know that we couldn't pinpoint it to any pharaoh. The story is just not lining up with the biography of any of the pharaohs. They have three pharaohs that they did narrow it down to, and in naming those pharaohs, they also admitted that there's only a few criteria that makes these claims, these hunches, plausible. So it's not conclusive. So that's for one. For one, we have 170 pharaohs, over 2,000 years of history, and this pharaoh that committed these war crimes against the Hebrews, it was only one of the 170, and we don't even know which one it was. So now, furthermore, we're looking for when in history did the Kama'u, the people of Kemet, actually hold on, you know, to Hebrew slaves. As a straight-up historical fact, there is no document that says, like, beyond a shadow of a doubt, or that says very existentially that, you know, I am Pharaoh such and such, and in this year of my reign, I've taken captive, you know, these Hebaru, which is one of the words that the Hebrews were called in the hieroglyphs. I've taken captive these Hebaru, and I've put them to labor doing these tasks. This is what they did. When you look at Kemetic records, that's how the records read. They say in the 28th year of my reign, in the 32nd, you know, count of the cattle, and in the coming of the season of the harvest, I sent, you know, five overseers of recruits with 200, you know, beasts of burden out into the desert to explore the way to the land of Tekebet. You know what I mean? Like, that's how the historical right. documentation sounds. We don't have documents like that say, I am Pharaoh Meren-Ra, and in my 10th year of reign, I've taken captive 1,000 Hebaru from, you know, the eastern land of Kinana, which is what they called Canaan, right? So we don't have a document like that. So what we're left to do is speculate. The theory is plausible on certain grounds because there was a lot of warring with people outside of Kemet. So it was very plausible that there were battles, and that, you know, once battles against Hebaru were won, that there were prisoners of war, and that those prisoners of war were put to labor. Theories that have circulated in the past about the Hebrews building the pyramids have been 100% rejected by the Israeli Jews themselves. They know that doesn't make any sense, because the Hebrew lineage does not go back as far as the building of the pyramids. It's not that those people did not exist, but they did not exist as a culture. They did not exist. You know, the Jewish history peaks at the closing, more towards the tail end of, you know, Kemet's historical time. So at the time when the pyramids were being built, the savvy was in the Nile Valley. Some, you know, highly savvy, highly skilled labor force of builders from the East just did not exist. When you look at the Nile Valley, we found over 250 pyramids on the Nile Valley. If we got builders from the East, you should be able to go in the East and find at least one pyramid there. We find zero.
That's a good point.
Right. Mm-hmm. So we're not, there's just no substantial evidence to support that claim. You know, so again, it's that is one of the sound bites that has, fallen victim to reductionism. When you reduce the details, you got to bring details into the story, like, you know, build the story out. So, okay, so we're going to believe that Hebrews came and, you know, with their labor, you know, all of these great things in Kemet were done. Okay, let's consider that. So let's look at the size of the Hebrew dwelling at the time. It was probably the size of, Southwest D.C., not even all of D.C. And the size of Kemet was like the size of America, because the Nile Valley is actually the same length of the United States from Maryland to California. There were 42 different nomes, 42 different distinct cities, all with different roles and responsibilities, all with different expertise. So when you're looking at the history of the building of the pyramids, you're seeing things like, these people had to, the material that they used in the building of the pyramid came from very far away. It came from quarries that were, you know, a little further south, and, you know, a lot of things had to be floated up the Nile and shipped and, you know, this, that, the other. And so we see the different administrative districts of Kemet, you know, working together the same way we see infrastructure systems working here in America. You know, we have trucks on the highway because wood comes from this state and steel comes from this state and, you know, glass comes from this other state, so there's in order to build skyscrapers, you got trucks on the highway. Well, it was the same kind of thing in Kemet. In order to build those pyramids, you had trucks on the highway, so to speak, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. And so we couldn't have relied just logistically. It was impossible to rely on some external group to come in and, as slaves, they're doing all this remarkable stuff. You know, it's just a complete ridiculous theory, and it's been rejected. You know. It's just, unfortunately, in popular culture, we just the stain of that propaganda, it makes it into the movies, it makes it into the magazines and the cartoons, and it floats around our ideas without any kind of discretion. Nobody really questions the validity of the story.
You know, you made a very good point that I think I don't want to be lost on the listeners when you mentioned the theory of the people. Some theories have been that the people came in from the East, and then when they got to Kemet, just started building all these pyramids, but there's no history or nothing can be found in the East that would show that they were building pyramids wherever they came from. You know,
right.
And I think that's a very important point, that just logically speaking, that if you came into Kemet and started building pyramids, then there should be some pyramids wherever you came from.
Right.
You know, so, I mean, that was a very powerful point, and I think that people need to really think about that when considering the validity of claims that the people outside of Kemet actually came in to build the pyramids. Also, you made a point earlier, and I just would like to go backtrack for a second. I think you said that a dynasty would last maybe between 80 and I think 100 and some years, and that there may have been five kings in a dynasty or something. That would say to me that the king's reign was very short. Would you agree with that? Is that a fact, that the reign of the king was normally not too many years?
No, some kings have very long reigns. Some kings were kings for their entire life. There were kings with short reigns, but there was definitely no rule of thumb, like, you know, like 4-year term, 10-year term, anything like that. The terms fluctuated very wildly. So there were kings that presided for only 5 years, and then there were kings that presided for over 30 years. You know.
Everybody, you have an opportunity to join the conversation. All you have to do is just press 1, and then I can bring you on, and you can ask your question of my special guest, Aninsa Amin, author of the awesome book Black Pharaoh. I mean, this is volume 1, okay? So that implies to me that there may be more volumes on the way, okay? But before we get back into the interview, I'd like to just give the listeners, tell them how they can get the book, because I know just from hearing you talk about this information, all of this information is in the book, family. So how can they get your book, Brother Nelson?
Sure, so the book is at shepsology.com. That's shepsology.com.
Mm-hmm.
And you can order it straight from that site. You can also get it at inside of the stores in your local Sarasota Society store. So there in D.C., we have SendBeb D.C. The book is being sold inside SendBeb D.C. If you're in Philadelphia, the Nile bookshop is being sold there, you know, and
okay.
we'll publish a list of retail outlets onto the site, but you know, for now, ordering through the site, you know, you can do that from anywhere. So that's shepsology.com.
Well, the phone lines are starting to light up, brother. Somebody wants to talk to you. Ready to take some calls?
Sure.
Okay, I'm gonna call the last four digits of your number. 0531, you're on the air with Brother Aninsa Amin. Thank you for your patience. Welcome to the show. You're on the air.
Hello?
0531, you're on the air.
Yes, how are you?
Good.
How are you? At the pool, this is Queen Mother Washtam. How are you?
Excellent. Queen Mother Mashta, my man, thank you so much for calling in. What a surprise.
Yes. Hi, Aninsa Amin. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you.
Yes, you're doing very, very, very well so far. Just call up to say that we are very proud of you. We've been waiting for this book, and it's been well worth waiting for. Something that I found in my life, people have different opinions of what kingship is, what queenship is, what queen mothership is. And you have really explained that well, and I'm glad that you've given us a lot of insight on that so we can really look at our own culture and our own history, and we can be very proud of what we did and what we have contributed to the world. Thank you so much for your beloved work. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much.
Yes, indeed.
Yes. Okay, thank you.
Peace and blessings.
All right.
Anybody else want to join the conversation? All you have to do is press 1, and I'll bring you on, and you can speak with Brother Aninsa Amin. In the book, you made a distinction, and you touched upon it earlier, and I think it's a very important distinction to make. But for the listeners who might not have read it yet, you make a distinction between the ancient Egyptians and Kemet. A lot of times people hear these two terms and, you know, if they don't know any better, they just use them interchangeably. One minute they may say Kemet, the next minute they may say ancient Egypt. But you make a distinction in the book. Could you talk about the distinction between ancient Egypt and Kemet?
Okay. So, depending on which way you look at it, the terms are synonymous. And then, you know, if we want to get really technical, then, you know, just for conversation's sake, we can separate the terms. So the point that I was trying to make when I said, you know, Kemet is not ancient Egypt, or Kemet came before ancient Egypt, the point I was making there was that, you know, when you look at the history of Egypt, if you're studying the history of Egypt in a university, You have Egypt itself, which is everything, you know, from its first president forward. And then you have, you know, Egypt, you know, the Republic, which was, you know, Egypt underneath its foreign dictators after the, you know, the sequence of conquests. You know, the Caliphate, the Ottoman, the British, you know, et cetera. And then you have a period prior to, you have a period that is contemporary with ancient Greece. And so this is a time in Egypt where the Greeks, the Romans, they're in power. They're in their own classical antiquity. And when you are looking at Egypt in the time of Herodotus, you can call that ancient Egypt. But my point there was that I like to tell people that, you know, ancient to us was Cleopatra, but ancient to Cleopatra was Khufu. And there was more time separating Cleopatra from Khufu than there is separating Cleopatra from us today. So Khufu was more ancient to Cleopatra than Cleopatra is ancient to us. So the point that I was making there was that when you go to ancient Greece, there's going to be a version of ancient Kemet. There's going to be an antiquity that does not include any Greek words or any English words. Nobody anywhere was speaking those words. So if we were to get in a time machine and go to the Nile Valley, you know, during the time of Cleopatra, we would have heard the word Pharaoh. We would have heard the word, not even Egypt yet, but maybe Egyptiaca or, you know, Hatkapetah or, you know, Copto. You know, we would have heard these words. We would have heard that language. We would have seen those words. If we got back in that time machine and travel to the time of Khufu, we get out of that capsule, we could have crossed the Mediterranean into Anatolia. We would not have heard the word Egypt. We would have not heard the word Pharaoh or anything remotely sounding like it. If we got out of the time machine and the pyramids were being built, there was nobody anywhere, even in Europe, that would have said Pharaoh or that would have said Egypt or that would have said Horus or anything like that. So when you say ancient Egypt, you're talking about contemporaneous with ancient Europe. And when you say Kemet, you're talking about the people who themselves called themselves, you know, Kemet, called their land Kemet, called their state Tawi, called themselves Kamau, you know. So that's that distinction.
You mentioned that back then, if you go back, that the people wouldn't call themselves, you wouldn't have heard the word Pharaoh, you wouldn't have heard the word Egypt. What would you have heard in terms of the people that we view as Pharaoh, end quote, quote, unquote? What would they have been called? So for those who today who say, oh, well, if that's a Greek term that I don't, you know, I would like to, you know, be factual when speaking about them, what would they actually be calling the people that we have come to know as pharaohs?
Right. So what the Greeks do is that they've taken words, you know, they've taken the Kemetic words and they kind of like create a word that sounds similar to the word or has the same phonetic parts of the word, but then has like a Greek style, linguistic style on it. You know, so when we say mesh, they take that mesh and they say Messies or Moses. You know, when we say Osir, they say Osiris. They put their own linguistic style on it.
Mm-hmm.
And with the kings had five names. You know, so the generic, and then there were several words for king itself also. So, you know, the titles were Nesu or Nesuit for, you know, female. You had Shechem, you had Shemsu Haru, you had, now the terms that connected, that they apparently took to construct the word Pharaoh was, you know, you have Paheru and you have Pera. You know, so those are two words that refer to king that phonetically mm-hmm. look like the word Pharaoh.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of just the mm-hmm. people themselves, they called themselves Kamau. You know, so the Kam is black and the Au, that A-U is, you know, is like God, you know, the divinity inside of the people, you know.
Well, who, I'm sure somebody is asking, who are the Hyksos? I mean, those, again, who have a passing knowledge of ancient Kemet, I'll say, or shall I say ancient Egypt in this particular case, who would the Hyksos be? Because at some point, the color of Egypt changed from dark to lighter. And at some point, through all of these invasions and wars and so forth, the Hyksos moved in. Who were they, and at what point did they move in?
Right. So, you know, again, you know, when we're dealing with history, we tend to underestimate the vastness of time and space, you know, when we speak about these things. So, when you're thinking about ancient Egypt, when you're thinking about Kemet, you have to think of a land the size of the United States of America. And when you think of the story of the Hyksos, you have to imagine Manhattan being invaded.
Okay.
So the Hyksos mm-hmm. did not invade America. The Hyksos invaded Manhattan. The Hyksos did not or could not have changed the color of the United States of America. They may have affected a few of the royal families, the color of a few of the royal families and elite families in Manhattan and confined only thereto. So the Manhattan I'm referring to would be the Nile Delta. So the Hyksos, they came and they occupied for a brief moment, a few generations, an area far into the north of the Nile Valley. They did not penetrate south at all. You know, Kemet is 42 states. It was the United States of Kemet, and people have to think about it in that way and understand that the further you go back in history, the harder it is to travel. So if you arrive in a place in ancient times that has 42 different districts, you're not just hopping from one to the other. Like, it's a massive, it's a serious big deal to go from the Delta just to Abydos, and then just to Elephantine, and then just to, you know, Nubia. Like, you know, to make those trips is, like, serious, you know. So the Hyksos, they were able to, you know, just take over one of the districts. And they stayed there, you know, for a while, but they definitely did not change the color of the people. You know, what happens, where do we get those stories in the first place? They changed the color of the people. Where we get those stories, again, Egyptology is archaeology of Egypt. So what happens is there was in the 1980s, the early 80s, there was a project called the Archaeological Survey of Nubia, where they dug up the graves of the mummies. Right, so they exhumed 8,000 bodies, and they cataloged these excavations and grouped them by period. So during the period of the Hyksos, they see a color difference in the mummies, but the people who were getting mummified were elite people. That's like if all of the American presidents were white, and then around the 90s we find like 3-4 black presidents. We're like, hey, what's going on here? Like, they're changing the color of America. Mm-hmm. No, they're not. They're changing the color of the leadership. You know, so it was like that. You know, so you had, and not only did you have interbreeding, you know, with conquerors, but there was also a time in Kemetic history where some of the kings confined to a certain region took on foreign brides and it had nothing to do with being conquered or, you know, the state being captured, you know, et cetera.
You know? Mm-hmm. Well, what about Upper and Lower Egypt and the different crowns or different, so I assume if you had different crowns, you had different kings, you had a king, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that reigned over Lower Egypt, and a king that, or for lack of a better term, Pharaoh king, that reigned over Upper Egypt. Is it to be, was there ever a point in time where you might have had, during this, as things were changing, the color was changing, was there ever a time where you had, say, for lack of a better term, an African person ruling over Upper or Lower Egypt while someone other than African was ruling the other section?
That's a great question. That's a very good question. That gives me an idea. That's something that should be represented visually, graphically. There are kingships, and then there is, so to speak, the crown, right? So there was this speaking of just the crown of the north and the crown of the south, right? That kind of hovered above whoever was the king, and then whoever were the paramount kings of the northern and southern districts. So there was a culture where they said that, you know, the red crown presided over, you know, lower Kemet, and the white crown presided over the upper, right? And so that was a metaphoric understanding, which meant that Lower Kemet, which is the north, was more the militarized zone, because it was the frontier where we had Libu people trying to invade, you know, from the northwest. We had Hebaru, you know, coming in from the northeast. And then we had seafaring people coming in from the Mediterranean, you know what I mean? So the north part of Kemet was met with more invasion attempts. It was also the city of Herakleopolis was also the beginning of the international export that we had. So it was the beginning of what was called King's Highway, which then in Asia connected to Silk Road, you know, which carried goods all the way out into East Asia and ancient China.
Mm-hmm.
So the north of Kemet was where wars happened. The north of Kemet is where trade happened, is where, you know, the greatest cities and metropolitan economic activities took place. So it was kind of like the outside. It was kind of like the front yard, you know, of Kemet, so to speak. Then, whereas in the south, you had the spirituality, right? So if you go all the way south, you have Ta Netir, the land where they're saying is the birth of the gods. If you go relatively south, relative to Herakleopolis, then you have you have the Temple University of Ipet Asu, which is now called Karnak and Luxor. So this is where astrology was born. This is where people were coming to learn Kemetic cosmologics in ancient times. You know, so in the south, you're dealing with the spiritual essence of Kemet. In the north, you're dealing with the urban economic essence of Kemet, right? So the crown, there was the crown, which was kind of like, how would we say that in modern terminology, kind of like the administration, the presidency of, so the institution and the entity of it. But then there were the kings themselves, which were, you know, which were subsidiary to, quote-unquote, the crown. And so at any one point in time, you had one king presiding over all of the north, and then you had the paramount kings. So who invaded and what seat did they usurp? When the Hyksos came in, I have to look at exactly, you know, which district it was, but their reign was only in the north, and at the t- time when they were in the north, there were definitely, you know, the other more southerly kings, you know, still in state. So you did have Africans and Hyksos, you know, at the same time holding office. And then where that dichotomy could look even more dramatic would be in the late dynasties. I think that question really, you know, turns into a whole, like, documentary film when you look at the late dynasties, when you have the Greeks and the Romans arrive, right? So when you have, like, the Ptolemies there, then that would be the time when you're really going to see, you know, a dramatic, you know, dichotomy where it's like it's known that, okay, Kemet right now has its indigenous and its foreign element, you know, coexisting, right? And so that would be the period when Taharqa and Pianki, you know, the brothers from down south Kemet, came up and said, we got to kick y'all out of here because you guys are, you're not from here, you're not doing what we do, how we do it. You know, that would actually make for a very great film. You know, nowadays we have the Tudors and the Game of Thrones. We have these classical European, you know, dramas, historical dramas. That would make for a very good, you know, screenplay to see, you know, Kemet divided, where we have these Europeans wearing they wore the clothes. They had the crowns on. And they sitting and presiding over black people. That's a very interesting aesthetic right there. And then you go down south, and you have these jet black African guys, Taharqa and Shabaka and Pianki, you know, same culture, and they're from the old culture. And what would they be saying about what's going on in the north, you know? Yeah, so that's you definitely saw that a few times in Kemetic history.
If we can talk about the Greeks for a moment, people have heard that, for example, Egypt, you know, supposedly the term Egypt means land of the blacks or land of the, you know, the dark-skinned people or something to that effect, and how it's been said that the Greeks came and sat at the feet of Egyptians and were taught mathematics, they were taught astrology, and then they would go back to Greece and, you know, share. I think, who was it? I can't think of the people's name off the top of my head that would, they talked about, not Homer, but other people around that time,
right.
Would share that, you know, this is what they learned, and they would bring back the stuff that they learned from the blacks in Egypt. Isn't that even an admission that because we have these people in their own words talking about the people of Kemet that they encountered when they went there and what they learned from them?
Right. Well, I mean, and that's documented fact. You know, they say if you want to hide something from people, put it in a book. But those books are there. All of that information is clearly documented. The Greeks, they wanted to be, you know, Kemet when they grew up, you know what I mean? Greece wanted to be Kemet when it grows up. Nowadays, today, America wants to be Kemet when it grows up, but that's another talk. The Greeks, you know, they sat at the foot of, you know, ancient Kemet, you know, was documented fact, but then it was also obvious. You know, they say that Euclid invented plane geometry, whereas when you go into Greece, you don't see as strong a body of evidence for the advanced use of geometry than when you come into Kemet. So when you come into Kemet, it wasn't just pyramids that they were using geometry for. They were using advanced geometry for agricultural plotting. So, you know, when you're cultivating a field, when you're on the 95 South and you're passing the cornfields in Maryland, you just see vast open land. Like, you just look and you just see like an open field, and it's hilly, and then there's a tree line, and that's where it stops. And they pretty much leave it as is, you know, unless you go like out west. But in Kemet, you know, the agricultural lands were these very deliberate rectangles. And the calculations, the geometric calculations that they used for land yield was extremely, you know, rigid, you know, in-depth mathematics. They knew if we had this amount of land with this amount of seeds, you know, based on the forecast that we're getting from the inundation, you know, telltale signs, that this is the amount of money we can make this year, this fiscal cycle. you know, in terms of philosophy, in terms of, you know, Greeks getting philosophy from Kemet, that's also very obvious. You know, philosophy, one of the terms that Cornel West loves to quote is that, you know, the life unexamined is the life not worth living. And, you know, so which connects to, you know thyself. Like, you have to, you know, self-knowledge is supreme. You know, they say that in anthropology also. Joseph Marie Degarando is like one of the fathers of anthropology. He quotes that philosophical term. Where did the questioning of life begin? Like, did the ancient Egyptians, you know, seek to know self? Were the ancient Egyptians looking into what is the meaning of man, what is the meaning of self and the meaning of the universe? Of course, they had like entire universities and libraries dedicated, you know, to knowing the self. You know, the Haramic cat, the what they call the Sphinx in Egypt, the Great Sphinx, is the world's largest know thyself monument. That it's like when you look at the Webster's dictionary and you open to the page that defines man, Western academics places the definition of man in a text on a page. Ancient Kemet placed the definition of man in a huge monument and said this definition, the definition of man, has to be city square for everybody to see. When you arrive in Kemet, we're going to show you our dictionary definition of self. You know? So that philosophy was born and was championed in Kemet. Is the proof is so big nobody thought to look at it. You know, you're thumbing through books. Where's the philosophy? Where's the philosophy? And you're sitting on the toe of the Sphinx, reading through books, saying, "Where's the philosophy?" And you're actually on a mega structure that says it's right here. You know, you've arrived. you know, but you know, everybody that has really read, you know, you just can't get past, you know, the evidence that that we really can't find anything at all that we can attribute to the Greeks that aren't beyond a shadow of a doubt, you know, founded in Kemet, you know, beyond their own admission. You know, so it's actually surprising that debate has even lasted this long.
You know, this interview is one that we're going to have to do a part two, because, I mean, I've got so many more questions, and I'm sure the listeners got questions. The phone lines, I mean, the board is just lit. I mean, maybe everybody's just taking notes, you know, blown away by this information. I'm going to tell you how you can get the book and give you the information on the book party that's coming up. But before I let you go, I just got to ask, what's in a name? I mean, you know, because your last comment was a great segue. We were talking about the Greeks. But what's in a name? You have a section in your book titled What's in a Name.
Right.
For the listeners, can you delve into just briefly what's in a name and why it's important to have understandings of names and who names what and why and the evidence of, like you mentioned it earlier, about how the Greeks would take certain phrases or whatever and take certain phonetics, and it'd be similar to the ancient Kemetic term, but not quite. But what's in the name and why is that important?
Right. And before I answer that, I want to just say to the listeners, this information is heavy, but don't hesitate to ask the simple question. The question that sounds simple in your mind is very important, and a lot of times we take for granted that something is simple, whereas really it's just containing a whole lot of very potent and very important information. So definitely don't, you know, feel that your question is too simple, too basic, too elementary. So yes, what's in a name? There's so much in a name, and you know, oh man, in the book I approach that so many different ways. In one way, you know, I say that by using the Greek words for everything, the Greek names of the Netaru and the Greek place names, we've hidden so much of the history. You actually hide, you know, clues. one particular, you know, mega clue that was hidden from us is in the name Akhet. So in the early dynasties, there was an expedition father and son business, Iri and Harkuf. So Iri was the father. He was chief lector to Nesu Meren-Ptah, and Meren Ra, right? So he was a chief lector to Meren Ra, and then to Pepi, right? And so Iri and his son Harkuf were expeditionists. They were the most celebrated deep desert explorers in the ancient Kemet, and so they were sent to find a place called Ta'aket. They were sent to find this place in order to trade with them, in order to send for some of the members of that society to come and do some of their legendary rituals. There were some ritual dances that they did in Ta'aket that, you know, the kings, you know, of northern Kemet wanted, you know, to invite and see and partake in. So Iri and Harkuf was sent, you know, to find this place, Ta'aket, and to communicate, you know, with these people. And in the history of Egyptology, we've gotten a lot of information from the artifacts that were buried. But in the last 100 years, there's been another branch of researchers, you know, that needs to receive more mention, and that's the deep desert explorers. So the Sahara Desert explorations over the last 100 years have been to trace the steps of Iri and Harkuf in their pursuit of a land called Ta'aket. And in studying, you know, this route, I discovered that, you know, there's a group of modern scientists by the name of Robert Bavall and Thomas Brophy. They say that, you know, they actually went out and did expeditions themselves, and they say that they believe that Ta'aket is Chad. They believe that the ancients were referring to the people who inhabited the region of the Tibesti Mountains in North Chad. Now, what's interesting is when you look at the word Akhet, A-K-H-E-T, we have rooted in that word K-H-E-T. When you look at the word Chad, you have C-H-A-D. When you look at, right, you know, Kemetic phonetics, you know, you find that et and ad are very similar, so much so that they're interchangeable. When you look at KH, K, and CH, CH, they're also interchangeable. For example, Khufu was called by the Greeks Cheops. So again, you have KH, you know, being swapped for the CH. So when you take the word cat, you can kind of swap it for the word Chad. So that right there was just, you know, that was interesting. It became mind-blowing when we dug into the story of the deep desert expeditions. So these explorers, they're going into the Sahara Desert from oasis to oasis, and they're finding hieroglyphs that are talking about some water mountain. At the first stop, they see this hieroglyph that says water mountain. And they're like, water mountain, what could that mean? They find another site, water mountain again. They find another site, water mountain. And so by the time Bavall and Brophy recently go out there some 10, 15 years ago, they say they're able to come to the conclusion, wait a minute, this water mountain, it's not referring to in ancient times in the Sahara Desert there was a water mountain here. These are highway markers letting you know you're on your way to the water mountain. or to the land of watermelons. And when you draw an arrow connecting the dots at from, you know, one stop to the other along this route, it points to the Tibesti and Eti Mountains, which are literally water mountains. So if you go into the Tibesti Mountains of North Chad, they are water mountains in terms of they get heavy monsoon rain every year. But then there's all of these hot springs inside them. There's all of these wadis at the foot of the mountain, you know, little water reservoirs, little ponds. It's a water mountain. Like you can live in the mountain because you have a constant supply of water coming out of the mountain and then raining down onto it. You know, so a lot of information came out of just looking at, let's use the word, you know, our cat. And a similar thing happens when you begin to use the Kemetic words for the gods, the Kemetic words for the kings and the common things. You start to get all of this history starts to unpack behind the proper use of the word, you know.
Yeah. Oh, man. So this is one of those interviews that could go on and on and on and on and on. And we've already gone past your time. I mean, I want to respect your time. I'll keep you if you let me. So I want to thank you and then for your time, brother. I know you got to run. Is there? We have to do a part two because we
Absolutely.
Just can't stop here. We got to do a part two to this, brother. Any was there any? Well, first of all, let me ask you: had you finalized your point on that? I don't want to cut you off
mid
thought concerned. Okay, cool. Everybody, you have been listening to a brother who's written a monumental book, and as you can tell, you got to go get the book. Okay, don't try to get all of the information from the book in this interview. Okay, this is just the tip of the iceberg. Okay, remember, this is volume one. Okay, this is volume one. All right, that implies there are going to be more volumes to come. So, my brother, first I want to congratulate you on the book. I mean, it's an awesome, awesome book. I'm still reading it, and just even after this interview, it's just going to make me want to go back. I can't wait to go back and pick up where I left off. And I encourage everybody to get the book, brother. And then, so before you go, any parting words for our listeners before I let you go? And everybody, I want you to hold on after, because I've got announcements to make. Tell you how you can get the book, how you can go to the book party that's going to be in Washington, D.C. on April the 7th. Any parting words for our listeners, Brother Inensa?
So I guess, to close out, I would say, you know, recently black people, you know, we've come a long way. We've really come a long way in the new world over here in America. We've come through... we've come through slavery. We've come through Jim Crow, several revolutions. We've invented a lot, and we're here now in the modern urban. We're in New York. We're in D.C., Philly. We're in the hood, you know. And, you know, one of the things that we're fighting for right now, and it's interesting that it's coming up in this next round of presidential debates, is that they're discussing reparations. You know, I guess these political candidates, they said, okay, what is the next best thing that you can do to being black and being Obama? And I guess they said, well, appealing to black and being like Obama. And so they've taken up, you know, reparations is actually being spoken about. I like to say that, you know, reparations is a measure of repair, a measure of return. In terms of what's been taken from a people. And, you know, the economic reparations pays tribute to the fact that we indeed built this country. I mean, we built D.C., we built the White House. We built up Lower Manhattan underneath the Dutch West Indies Company. We really did build, you know, this country culturally speaking, in terms of giving it its music, its food, even rice, you know, rice planting and a lot of the, you know, the breads and the things that we produce here came from African agricultural knowledge that was brought with the slaves. But perhaps the most important thing that was taken from us was knowledge of self and knowledge of our identity, both historically and spiritually. So I would say that one thing that we have to add to the bill of loss and the bill of reparations is self-knowledge, and that's the that's something that, that we can pay unto ourselves. And so I would like you know this book to be part of a movement for us to make reparations more dynamic and having two hemispheres. Like on one side, you have to give us some of the money because we're the ones that made the wealth possible in the first place. So it's actually owed to us. But then on the other side, and that's something that that's something that America can cut a check for. But then there's part of the reparations that we need to give to ourselves, you know, so auto-active reparations, which is, you know, returning ourselves to our knowledge of who we are. So I would just leave the listeners with that.
Well, brother, you've left us with an awful, awful lot. And, again, I want to let everybody know, make sure I got this website address correct. They can get your book at www.shepsology.com?
That's correct.
Okay. And the book party is coming up, brother, brother, and this again, let me thank you again, congratulate you again on an awesome, awesome offering. We will benefit immensely from this work that you have. And again, everybody, you've got to get the book. You just heard, you heard the interview, okay? You heard a summary of the book, okay?
Right.
You got to get the book, okay? So definitely go to www.shepsology, that's S-H-E-P like Paul, S like Sam, O-L-O-G-Y.com, shepsology.com. Brother Anensa, I'm just going to tell everybody about the book party you got coming up. I know you said you got to run. So, again, I want to thank you so much, my brother. Anytime, you're welcome to come back. We can do a part two, part three, part four if necessary, because this information is food. And so I want to thank you for cooking up a wonderful meal for us today, my brother. Heads up to you.
Okay, appreciate you, brother.
Okay, peace and blessings. Talk to you soon. Everybody, that is Anensa Amen, author of the book, Black Pharaoh, Volume 1. Okay, now let me tell you about the book party. Okay, there is going to be a book party in Washington, D.C. on Sunday, April the 7th, and that's going to be from 4 p.m. till 8 p.m., and it's the Black Pharaoh book party. Okay, so if you're in the Washington, D.C. area, you definitely want to make sure that you are there. Okay, where else would you be? Okay, after hearing this show, right, where else would you be on Sunday afternoon, April the 7th? It's from 4 to 8 p.m. At 4 p.m., there's going to be the book signing, there's going to be cuisine, there's going to be networking, and starting at 5, that's the lecture. Okay, and that's going to be presented. This is going to be presented by, and then I'm in, and there's going to be question and answer period, and for all of that, it's only $10. $10. You hear me? $10 for all of that. Okay, that's going to be again. Write it down. Make sure you write it on your calendar. $10. You can take somebody with you. Okay, and pay their way. Take a couple of people. I mean, because when this information is so powerful that you want to expose your children to this information. Okay, as you could see from listening to today's show, he can talk about it on a collegiate level and he can break it down. So bring some young people, you know, make it a point to bring some young people so that you can educate them so that they can get this information while they're young and that while their minds are impressionable and you can help to combat the false information that's being put out there when they go into school and they're hearing about this and that and the other. You want to give them the facts, okay? So take somebody with you, even if they're not a youngster. I mean, take somebody that you know would like to be there. There's some people, as I mentioned recently, that want to be at certain events, but for whatever reason, they just don't have it. This is so affordable that don't wait for them to ask you, you know. Offer it. Listen, man, I'm going to the book party at the Sarasota Society in Washington, D.C. on Sunday. Man, what you doing? You want to come? Bring somebody with you, okay? Because it's that important, and this information is, it can be really transformative. So, again, that's Sunday, April the 7th, from 4 p.m. until 8 p.m. And that's going to be at 733 Euclid Street, Northwest, Washington, D.C. And the zip code there, in case you need to MapQuest it, is 20001. Again, that's 733 Euclid Street, Northwest, Washington, D.C. The zip code there is 20001. If you'd like more information, call this number, 202-630-2507. Again, that's 202-630-2507. Okay? And let me give you an email address in case you want to email for more information. That's info@shepsology.com. Again, that's INF, like Frank O, at Shepsology. That's SHEP, like Paul, SOLOGY.com. Okay? And again, you like more information, again, call that number I gave you. Also, you can go to www.oserosetdc.org. Again, that's www.oserosetdc. That's AUSAR. Oset is AUS, like Sam, ET, DC, as in the city, DC.org. Okay? So, everybody, this is going to be fabulous. I mean, a book party talking about everything that you just heard. Okay? Everything that you just heard. Now, don't you want to get the book? This is a book that people have in their libraries, but not, this is not a book that you just want to put on the shelf just to say you got it. I mean, some things become faddish. You know what I mean? Where people say, well, you know, I got that book. You know, I got the book. Did you get Anissa's book? Yeah, I got the book. You know, I got that book. But did you read the book? Did you read it? Okay. And it's not a book, an ABC 123 book. You got to read it. As I mentioned before, sit with it for a while, read some more, chew on it. Okay. Because being deprogrammed is a process. You know, we don't want to just take the position that, oh, okay, I guess I got it. The pharaohs were black. Okay, but you may have to share this information with your children one day, as other cultures do, and sit down and share the history that they know with their children, and as a result of that, it gives their children a sense of pride, and they grow up feeling good about themselves because they know who they are. Well, the ancient Egyptian adage is know thyself. You can help, as you educate yourself, to educate those that are coming behind us by passing on knowledge. Okay? Now, you want to get the knowledge? Get the book. Go to the book party and support this awesome, awesome work. Again, that's Sunday, April the 7th, 4 p.m. to 8 p.m., okay? That's 4 hours you can have a ball, okay, from 4 p.m. to 8 p.m., and that's going to be at 733 Euclid Street, Northwest, Washington, D.C. Zip code there is 20001. You want more information, call 202-630-2500. And if you're not in the Washington, D.C. area and you just want to get the book, you can go to www.shepsology.com and order the book. That's S-H-E-P-S-O-L-O-G-Y.com. Now, got another announcement to make. On April the 3rd, Tahuti Kamo is going to be my special guest again. He was just on the show yesterday. We were talking about the Atefu Conference. You need to go back and listen to that show, everybody, by the way. Before I give you this announcement, let me tell you how you can go back and listen to the show. If you don't already follow this show, you can follow it by just clicking follow. If you're listening online, all you have to do is just click follow, and then you'll be notified every time I do a show. You'll be notified of the date. You'll be notified of the author, I'm sorry, the guest, the time, and the topic. Again, you'll be notified of the guest, the date, the time, and the topic. If you're listening by phone and you're like, well, what's the web address? If you just got the phone number but you don't have the web address, it's www.blogtalkradio.com. That's B-L-O-G, talk like I'm talking, blogtalkradio.com. / Jawanza for life. The number 4. Okay, that's JAWAN like Nigeria, Z like Zimbabwe, A. The number 4, life, LIFE. If you go there, you click that link, it will take you to my particular show called Juwanza for Life, also known as Health, Wealth, and Divine. If you click follow, then you will be notified every time I do a show. Now, back to what I was saying. On April the 3rd, Orwa Amtahudi Kamo is going to be my special guest, and he's going to be talking about the MIN system, M-I-N intensive. Okay, there's going to be a men's system intensive, okay, that is going to be coming up again as the ATEFU conference. I'm preparing for the ATEFU conference. You don't want to miss that show, okay? Brothers, you really need to listen to that show, okay? I'm telling you, you need to listen to that show. You need to learn how to harness your energy, how to cultivate your energy. Everything is energy. You need to know about cycles. You need to know about your body. You need to know about how all of these things affect you in the big picture. Okay, there's a big picture. Okay, we're put here on this planet, not by accident. You know, it wasn't. We're not just some random meeting of a sperm and an egg. We have a purpose and a plan, but within that plan, there's a way and there are techniques that can help us, okay, to not only just to live a healthy life, but within the big scheme of things, to understand why we're here. We're going to be talking about all of that on April the 3rd that's going to be, by the way, from 11 to 12 noon, okay? And it's going to be from 11 to 12 noon. April the 3rd. You want to meet us there, okay? My special guest is going to be Orwa Amtahudi Kamo. Now, if you enjoyed this show and you were going to be in the D.C. area, again, take somebody with you. Where's the party at? The party is at it's not going to be at Simbab, okay, but while you're in D.C., if you're coming from Baltimore or whatever, stop by Simbab Cafe. You know where that is, right? But this is going to be Sunday, April the 7th, 4 to 8 p.m. Where? At 733 Euclid Street Northwest 20011. It's the Black Pharaoh Book Party featuring Inensa Amen. It's the Zayaset Society Presents, and I'm so happy to be able to bring this information to you. Everybody, I want you to check out the archives. If you're listening to the show for the first time, we've got shows with Dr. Raun Nefer Amen. The last show I did with him was on Kundalini Yoga. That show is in the archives. Show on his book, Stress Fee for Life. That show is in the archives. Just did a show yesterday with, again, Orwa Amtahudi Kamo on the ATEFU conference. That show is in the archives. Always doing shows with Dr. Orwa, Hehi Medora and Comet. Shows on the 11 laws of God. You want to know about the 11 laws of God? You want to hear a breakdown of each faculty of the 11 laws of God? Those shows are in the archives. Okay, we did a show on God Knows Best on the I Ching. You familiar with the I Ching? You want to learn more about the I Ching? Listen to that show. That show is in the archives. Everybody that's listening out there, how are you and your relationships doing? You want to hear a show about relationships? I mean, an awesome show about relationships. Well, or what? Mater Arit did a show called Healing and Nurturing Your Spiritual Relationships. Again, Healing and Nurturing Your Spiritual Relationships. You got to hear that show. If you're in a relationship or you're thinking about getting in a relationship or if you're thinking about getting out of a relationship, before you do, you need to hear that show, okay? That show is in the archives. Now, the archives has about 9 pages. So if you don't see it on the first page, then just keep clicking over and checking the other pages out because it has about 9 pages on it. You want to learn about meditation? Did a show with Amhetrahim Ma'at on meditation is more than just breathing and relaxation. Awesome, awesome show on meditation and why we need to meditate, what meditation is. Okay, you need to hear those shows. We've got shows with Hexham Suheru, Shechem Meyam Neter on different, we did shows on mid-air meditation, on the spring equinoxes, the solstices. I mean, you got to hear those shows. I mean, awesome, awesome shows. I mean, just shows with Sanupara, Keparang on Bazi Astrology. These shows are all in the archives. This format has been created for you so that you can have a place to go, okay, when it's not, when you're not at the HESP, but you need this food, right? You're hungry. You're hungering for it, right? You need this food. You want this food. There's a place that you can come, and it's here, okay, where you can come and get fed, and you can listen to these shows over and over and over again. And to those who like the shows, my question is, do you like them enough to share them? You know, I see on Facebook sometimes somebody might click like, but I don't see that they clicked share. Well, I'm glad that you like it, but do you like it enough to share it? Share this meal. How else would you have gotten this information to tune in today had not somebody shared this information with you? That's how you got the information, right? That's how you came to know that Anensa Amen was going to be on the show today. Somebody shared the information with you, whether it's via text, whether it's via Facebook, social media. Somebody shared it with you. That's how you got it. So now do the same. Do the Ma'atian thing. Share the link with somebody else. If you got this on Facebook, all you have to do is just click share and share it with your people. Okay? We want to make sure that everybody gets this information because you know what? We're living on this planet and we want to make it better, right? So the only way we can make it better is if people like you and me hear information that we know is life-changing and share it with the people that we know. Okay? So, again, thank you, Duau. Thank you so much for your time. You could be doing anything, as I always say, but you took time out of your day to spend it with my person and Brother Anensa. Amen. Awesome, awesome show. I learned a lot, and I hope that you did too. And I hope that you share the link because I know you're not going to try to go back and share and remember everything that he said and try to share it, right? Let him share it for himself. Share the link. And come to the book party on April the 7th, all right? Everybody, thank you again. My name is Jawanza. Who am I? I'm the one who in giving receives more. Who are you? It's that.